We're super excited today.
You want to start this one?
Are we starting?
You can start.
You can start too.
Welcome to the Creative Circle Podcast, the show where we talk to creative professionals and attempt to find out some of the secrets to their success. With me, as always, is Aaron Evans. Aaron, who is our guest today?
I'm super excited because today we're talking to Bob Williams, a good friend of mine who used to be kind of a teacher of sorts to me. And basically, he's a painter and was an instructor in commercial art at a college here, South Central College, for many years, and really saw a lot of not only the changes in technology, but really understands the things that stay constant, both in education and in becoming a good artist and a good designer. So,
sweet. And he's actually in studio here, so let's talk to him.
Well, today we're excited to have... Can I call you Bob? Or?
Yeah.
We're excited to have Bob Williams in the studio today. Bob was kind of a teacher of mine for many years, and he's been a painter, taught commercial art at South Central College for many years. Thanks for joining us, Bob.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm honored to be here, Aaron.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about kind of how you got started into teaching and that, and into art as a career?
Well, sure. In our high school, back in the 60s, we didn't have too much in art, but I knew I wanted to be an artist somehow. Went into the service and went back to college, but it still wasn't quite what I wanted. But I heard about a technical course up at the Mankato Area Technical College, they called it that time, and Rod Furin was the teacher there, and I went in and showed him some work, and I got right in. And it was an ideal setting where it was almost like a one-room schoolhouse, and you taught you everything about art, figure drawing, animal drawing, everything that would identify with final output to press. Mm-hmm. I had a job in Sleepy Eye for about 3 years, 3.5 years, and a year and a half maybe in the cities at a studio. And then Owatonna at Johnston's. And then, as I was getting bored with that job in Owatonna, my teacher, Rod Furin, called up and said, I'm going to go to California. You want my job? I got up off the floor, and I said, sure. and we made our move back to Mankato. And was there then in that teaching position for 30 years. And during that time, then a digital or the computer came in and got to be on the ground floor with that. And with the connections with Sleepy Eye, Haas Corporation, I got to meet some wonderful people there that actually started inventing the output to digital nationwide. And it was, and along with Carlson Craft and the Taylor Corporations, they were tremendous supporters throughout the 30 years I taught there. Mm-hmm. So it was really quite a blessing to get that job and meet so many young people and be with them. That was kept you young.
Mm-hmm. Was there any kind of hesitancy or fear on your part taking your instructor's job?
Absolutely.
Far as not feeling...
I never thought I was a teacher. And then I thought, well, you know, the night before I asked God, well, I don't think I'm doing the right thing. What do you want me to do? And then the call came. So he opens up those windows. And I said, okay. And it's unusual to sit in front of people and have them watch you and watch you make mistakes. And then, as I was telling when I first... I was trying to think of what to say when I was leaving SEC. I said, you know, it didn't take a lot of, a lot of people said it didn't take a lot of common sense to take a teaching job because there was no money in it. And they were right. And then I said, then I found it took a lot of common sense in order to actually be successful in this work. And then after a while, and as you mature as a teacher, it takes uncommon sense to realize it's not what you hear, it's what you don't hear that actually helps you direct people. Mm-hmm. It helps them to where they should be going.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, again, a wonderful blessing to have an opportunity to be a teacher and to learn how to be a teacher during mm-hmm. that time. Did I answer that?
Yeah, I think you did. What maybe more specifically do you mean by it's about what you don't hear rather than what you hear? Is that what you hear from students? Or
no, it's you have so many students that come to you,
mm-hmm.
and they're confused,
mm-hmm.
and they're afraid to fail. And actually, you have to help them get rid of the feeling of failure, because our greatest discoveries are through failure.
Mm-hmm.
You have to keep failing in order to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And when people withdraw, they tell you a lot. Why? By what they say, what they don't say, how they position themselves,
mm-hmm.
how they address you. And the greatest thing you can give them or offer them as a teacher is that safeguard that if they fail, it's okay,
mm-hmm.
that you'll help direct them through it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times you'll find students that you'll just have to sit down and say, you know, this isn't for you. What else would you like to do?
Mm-hmm.
And they'll feel maybe that they were pressured to go that direction. And maybe the greatest reward then as a teacher is to help redirect them.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
We hear this a lot, that, you know, you have to do stuff that scares you, and you have to, you know, not be afraid to fail. Is there a way that maybe students could set themselves up for a controlled failure, so that they could have that experience and not be so afraid of it next time it comes up?
You simply have to find good people around you. You have to find some people, like we were mentioning before, the John Berkey,
mm-hmm.
professional people that take an interest in you. Or if you have friends that to help you make it through those mistakes. If you don't have those, be guarded.
You need a support
system. Because you'll be put into a box, and you'll never get out of it. Always find people who say, "Well, give it a try. You know, I'll be here."
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times you'll say, "Well, what about that direction? What should I do, or what should I say, or where can I go to make this positive failure?" And I guess you'll have to, if you were a believer, then you have to ask God for that.
Mm-hmm.
Or you just have to keep your mind open and watch, and it'll come right to you. You just have to be ready to accept it. And it might be something that you had no idea was coming at you. Absolutely no idea.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, okay, help me through this. And you'll be just fine. Just go after it. In a painting, people, even if they don't have any instruction, they know if you're afraid just by the strokes that you make.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking earlier about digital and how it's becoming so natural for everything. But yet, whenever I would look at someone's handwriting, that would tell me the most about them. That every time you put your hand down on something, you were the only person who could ever make that line or make that ability or character. Is you alone. Nobody else will ever be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so make sure that you realize that you are absolutely unique. And as a teacher, that's so important to remember, that they may not have the same attributes that you'd hope for or that they think they should have.
Mm-hmm.
But helping them find their way or find their uniqueness and keeping them unafraid to give it a try is your greatest challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Did that answer that?
I think, yeah, definitely. I think that's some really good insights
mm-hmm.
on that. I think it is really important to be able to provide that for students. That's kind of what I've found where I'm going to school is that's kind of the most important thing, is having those people mm-hmm. who can help you through those things.
I remember my mother just passed away, and she would recall her grandmother, and she would be playing the piano, and she would hit the sour notes, and her grandmother would say, "Oh, that was so beautiful." meaning that it didn't matter about the sour notes. It meant that you had to keep trying.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really had it, had that ability, and it goes back to remembering, too, that I've heard this, too, but my brother, he didn't come back from the Vietnam War, but he told my mother that he sang in high school, and he wanted to take lessons when he came back, and he wanted to sing just to make people feel good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd like to paint just to make people feel good.
Mm.
A lot of people go into a career that, of course, money does matter. You have to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And but if you soon take the attitude that you're doing it for a purpose to help someone, you're never going to be out of a job.
Mm-hmm.
When you can put yourself second or last and make them feel most important in what they need to get or have, mm-hmm. or to help them out, they'll be coming to you. Word will get around, and in the art world, it's a small world.
Mm-hmm.
And once people realize your attitude about your ability and how you want to help, not so much yourself, but other people, they'll be after you.
Yeah.
Because they need that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the things that may be coming up as a problem to solve visually or any other way, if you identify it to the person and their needs, a lot of those problems will be automatically solved.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it much easier to get rid of the feeling of yourself all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That help?
Yeah, I think it definitely does. It is really important to have kind of that higher level of thinking about your work than just this line is right or this color has been put in realistically.
Mm-hmm.
It's being able to really think about it as a way of meeting the needs of your viewer or client and being someone who's fun to work with. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally.
Higher means lower. Kind of lower your opinion of yourself, but mm-hmm. I raise the people's opinions of themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you think kind of the format of the way... Explain a little bit about the format of the school that you were teaching in, because that's quite a bit different than maybe most people's experiences in school. Do you feel that I think in a lot of ways that sounds like that was really helpful in getting to know your students better and maybe identifying some of those things?
Well, our teacher, Rod Furin, put together an atmosphere that's changed since I left, but it was ideal. You were in a home room. He was your teacher, your parent, he managed you, mm-hmm. made sure that you got the most out of it, or he'll took you back and talked to you a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And people seem to really grow when they have that contact of having one person that is... in this case, Rod Furin was so talented he could do about everything and teach everything that if you had a concern, you were right there. Not only did you build a good relationship one with one person who could not only direct you there, but also throughout your whole career, every job I got, he helped me get.
Hmm.
But that not only doesn't stop there, it also... When you have a home room like that and the contacts you make within your peers as far as other students, you're always in contact with the rest of your career.
Mm-hmm.
And that closeness is really quite an advantage. I have a little concerns about classes where people get up and are there a couple of hours and then they leave and maybe come in maybe a couple of times a week and that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
I found that in one close classroom atmosphere, you were taught how to work and the merits of working and also the merits of being pressured mm-hmm. and being pushed to your limit and a little bit beyond mm-hmm. and say, oh, as one student told me, she said, I had no idea I could do all that, you know. Mm-hmm. But when you do have that type of atmosphere, that one-room classroom atmosphere, you do have an advantage. And I know that's a financial consideration nowadays. Mm-hmm. And but still, I think, I'm starting to teach private lessons now.
Oh, yeah.
And I find that rewarding. Hmm. And I think the students do, too. Mm-hmm. But you can go one-to-one and find out who they are, what they are, what their background is, mm-hmm. and then give them some good, solid steps and then help them focus on what they're most interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fun way to do it.
I think that kind of that master-apprentice relationship that you're talking about is really important to any school that someone chooses to go mm-hmm. to, and one of the best things about the school that I'm going to right now is I've found people who are like that,
mm-hmm.
where even if it's more of a traditional school where you have classes, the professors mm-hmm. you know, are available at other times, and you spend a lot of time with them outside of class, and that's mm-hmm. where the real learning takes place a lot of the time.
Do you have some teachers that corner you and actually put a little pressure on you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's mm-hmm. good.
Yeah, I'm good friends with a number of my teachers, so
mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of time with them.
Yeah.
So
and they kind of pick you up and mm-hmm. and brush you off and get you going again?
Yeah, and not only them, but also the other students here. Because mm-hmm. I think at any good school, there'll always be a core group of really dedicated students
yeah.
that help mm-hmm. each other out.
Yeah.
So that's a huge part of it, too.
Mm-hmm.
So
good.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to focus, too, as far as where you want to go.
I do. I'm getting there, getting more focused.
Yeah. Do you see it, the focus changing as the technology changes?
I don't know so much changing with the technology as much as changing with, I get a better understanding of what's out there and what other work is being done
mm-hmm.
and just trying lots of things and figuring out, oh, okay, I actually like this thing better than that other thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
I remember we taught some core job skills or some basic job skills, and do you have some that you found that are essential to actually building on as you go?
In ours
it was just drawing, knowing mm-hmm. how to draw, or in other words, how to think.
Mm-hmm.
And drawing was nothing. Good drawing was nothing more than good thinking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And do you have those skills, like computer skills or design skills? That
yeah, I think there are some similarities. Your students were looking at more illustration, graphic design type things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm similar to that. Good drawing skills, I think, is good for somebody working in any sort of design or media.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that I'm working on improving. So I can draw tolerably well.
Making storyboarding so that you can project an idea that you have.
Mm-hmm.
But you're like a conductor, too. You've got not only the technical skills, the sound skills, you've got the drawing skills. So mm-hmm. you're like a conductor in a symphony. You've got different instruments that you have to make and pull together to make it all work.
Yeah, and I think I'm not the best sound guy ever. You know, mm-hmm. I have a rudimentary understanding of it, but I think it is important for people who are going into more of the video production, motion graphics side of things.
But it's really important, too, for you, though, isn't mm-hmm. it, to find out what you're best at, but also have other people that have
skills.
A better knack
mm-hmm.
and feel more comfortable with it.
Yeah, it's really mm-hmm. helpful to have other students and professors whose strengths kind of balance out my own, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I guess as far as going back to core skills that are important, as far as design things, I think typography is something that's really weak in me right now,
mm-hmm.
and something that I consistently hear industry people say we wish students focused more on some of those basic things. software. It's good to know software to a certain extent. A lot of the jobs that I'm looking at will require pretty in-depth knowledge of the software, but what they really mean is, yes, we want you to know where the buttons are, but more importantly, we want to know if you know when to use those and why it should be this color and how things move.
Meaning, if you can think.
Yeah. It's the thinking. The thinking skills that are harder to pin down are really the more important things.
Yeah.
Definitely. Was it a challenging transition to go from pre-digital technology to digital? Like, how quickly did that come about?
We were pretty excited. I was pretty excited. And Kurt Thermisgard was a consultant over it at that time. It was called AUI or Haas Corporation. And now it's become a number of different names, but it's the largest calendar company in the United States over in Sleepy Eye. And I said, boy, isn't this great? And he turned to me, went out for lunch with them. Mm-hmm. And he came from California. He actually helped pioneer what JPEG would be.
Oh, really?
You know, a joint expert group. And and he said, yeah, as long as people don't get tired of change. Because he could see that this is just the beginning. It's just going to blossom. It's just going to take off. And that's one thing, I guess, it doesn't bother me too much after retirement, is I don't have to keep up with the constant change.
Yeah.
And I can focus more on the drawing and the painting things that I do now, but I can't stay away from that too long, because I do have a lot of work in the digital that I need to keep moving, because there's a lot of merit to it. But also, as you paint, you've got to have a mini pad to advertise yourself and be able to communicate with other people.
Right.
That's part of our communication skill now. You can't get away from it. I remember one time there was a student, and they had to do an interview and then an illustration for a magazine. And I thought, maybe they were on the internet a little bit too long. I said, well, maybe you should pull back on that. And he came up and said, well, no, I'm doing my interview. So that was kind of a real the student becomes a teacher, because you can't keep up with it all. All the people around you become teachers to each other. And he was then taught me that I've got to have this skill in order to get a job and to get the job done right. And I said, oh, yeah, you're right.
About what year was it when those changes kind of came through?
1985.
So you guys were really on the cutting edge almost?
We were one of the first in using Cork Express. That was before the Creative, and that was a heck of a good software. But they became bogged down with themselves. And when the Adobe Creative Series came out, it just blew everything away. Because that's what the industry needed, something that would talk to each other. And we started out with black and white, and our first printer was of one color, and it took forever to print out, but the Apple printer, it must have weighed almost 80 pounds, and it cost $4,000.
Yeah.
It was pretty exciting. But it took maybe 2 weeks for me to get the first computer out. But after a while, we did all the networking ourselves. That was before the school actually started doing networking. And we had wires all over the place, and it was pretty hectic and exciting at the same time.
Yeah. Were those Apple machines really early on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I remember when we got an Apple II, that was big time. That was, I think that was $3,000 for one of those, and that was really putting ourselves on the limb. And then we had to take turns. We couldn't get everybody on a computer, so everybody had to take turns, and that was interesting. And since then, now, too, is that printing has changed so much.
Right.
And it's made things move much faster. And it used to be where people used their hands more, And now the artists, when I first came, you could do paste up, and that you could make a living on. But now you have to be a paste up artist. You have to be an illustrator. You have to be. You have to wear half a dozen hats in order to get a job now. Besides, be able to communicate and write and read and but we knew that was coming. Advertising Age, it's a magazine that is out there. They talked about that well ahead of when it would hit. And I think the European countries foretold us, too, that that's what was going to come. And it took a little time, but it did make its appearance then for us. So it's a unique challenge for the creative person nowadays.
Right.
To get into it.
Do you think technology was the thing that kind of precipitated that need to be more of a, maybe not a well-rounded person, but have more diverse skill sets?
Absolutely, because it...
Because it opened it up to...
It opened it up to... a precision and a expedience of how fast to get the job done. And, of course, in a market like ours, it's competitive. And if you can't make the decision quicker than the next person and get it out there and do a thorough job of it and do an accurate job, but you lose your client. It's just a matter of budget, and you've got to be able to have a good, concise pattern of learning and thinking in order to get out there and not only compete but stick to the wall, as they would call it. You come in, try for the job. We'll stick you against the wall. If you don't make it, then you leave. That's how it works. And those that have the basic learning skills of communication and drawing and some design and typography is just, once you get into typography, we taught show card lettering and sign lettering and calligraphy, and we'd have students return and they said their artwork was great but their typography was terrible. Come back when you do a better job. We took typography just and typed too much for granted, and typography is an art, and you don't even have to have illustration. You can just use typography,
right?
And that's one of the things that in the projects I work with is that I'll do maybe a realistic, a design type of approach, and a typographical approach, and there are three separate ones, three different distinct looks. And a client likes that, to have something to choose from.
Right. Do you continue to use digital tools at all in the creation of kind of the work you're doing now? Or?
Oh, yes. Yes, I can take a picture of something. I can crop it. I can throw different filters on with Photoshop and just get in a kind of a step. See, where should I be thinking? How should could I think of this? A little easier.
So you use it to kind of plan ahead what you might do in a traditional medium?
Sure, yeah. And I wasn't too aware of this, and I'm not really a great mathematician, but I did learn as a teacher that the eye sees mathematically and fell in love with grids. And and the golden rule, and I was just amazed how each of us think mathematically, and I'm still not great in the advanced math, but when I see the grid and see the possibilities that occur, not so much that you start with a grid, but you fine-tune your first drawing with a grid and make sure it sets right. My gosh, you just can't go wrong. It's there's something about intersecting lines and finding where your stress points and the unity and the principles of design and objects that the grid is just almost you can't do without it, really, mm-hmm. and do a good job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, having that composition just right makes everything so much stronger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think those that are in photography, they work in threes of thirds, and that's a good place to start.
Mm-hmm. Before I move on to something else, just going back to the teaching briefly, were there certain maybe attitudes or mindsets that students had coming into school that helped them thrive more? Or what advice would you have for students kind of starting out as they're thinking about how they should approach that?
I guess when you're a student, you're actually there to find out if this is what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Keep them an open mind, because you might find out that in many cases the students that left us and graduated, they went on to do something else. And I realized that too. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much that you're going to teach them a lifelong skill that they're going to use forever, but mm-hmm. you were teaching them how to teaching them the confidence of overcoming and learning and being able to take care of themselves and make mm-hmm. a living. That was the most important.
Yeah.
And from there, they could find out that, I should run a press instead, or I should run something else. I'd love mm-hmm. to do that instead.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave them the confidence.
Mm-hmm.
It's just getting over that, I think. In many cases, we found a lot of the students that found it so easy that there was no need for them to even try any harder. They could do it so easy that they lost interest. It's again those people that maybe had a marginal talent that said, this is what I want, this is where I'm going to go, mm-hmm. and I'm going to just hang in there, mm-hmm. and they did make something of it, and, mm-hmm. and they kept it going.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to also realize again with new technology that you have to be able to change continually.
Mm-hmm.
The basics don't change. The drawing doesn't change.
Mm-hmm.
The typography doesn't change. It's being able to how to use it and being able to adjust with the change. You have to be that flexible.
Right. I like what you said about students learning things, not necessarily the thing that they're going to be doing forever after they graduate, but just... Mm-hmm. Learning how to learn on your own and learning how to think mm-hmm. on your own is so huge in education as a whole.
Well, once they've got that behind them
mm-hmm.
and they know they can succeed at something, they're not afraid to try it. And there it goes back to that mm-hmm. original concern about not being afraid to fail.
Mm-hmm.
Just give it a try and see if it does work. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, get away from it. Try another approach or go somewhere else with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, along similar lines there, like thinking about drawing and whatnot as these core competencies, are there any, for lack of a better word, classes or maybe experiences outside of the realm of design and typography which you think are extremely beneficial for students or other people to have or do that would somehow help them in the design world?
Mm-hmm. I was asked by one lady at the Amboy Cafe. She wanted to know who was my best teacher, and I said, "I guess I am," because there again, you'll get fragments of the basics, but it's up to you. And I'm concerned about. There's a lot of push for being competitive, and I think being competitive is a source of fear. And when you're competitive to yourself and that you want to be the best you can be all the time, don't look at the other person. Be the best that you can see and you understand, and keep your eyes open and watch what other people are doing, and then identify it to what you'd like to do. That's the best I can tell them as far as learning. because you can sit down at a piano or you can sit down at anything, and you're just chunking along, and you'll learn some of the basics and the skills, but there's no heart in it. And I like to think of it as if you don't have a purpose for it, you know, get out of it. Because if there's no purpose, you're not going to be happy. Mm-hmm. And I found people being a little agitated toward me because I didn't compete so much. And I said, you can't compete for someone who's giving all the time. My greatest reward is giving. And I get jobs coming in on me. Until I don't want them anymore, you know, but I want to help people. Mm-hmm. And once that's there, and you're flexible to their needs and to their pocketbook, you're always going to be busy, mm-hmm. maybe not rich, but you're going to be happy, mm-hmm. and you're going to be helping people. Did I answer that?
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's a fantastic
little insight. It's not about you, it's about the people around you. I remember there was a lady, I went to a conference up in the cities, and it was on press work, and there was a lady there that she just drummed around you. She just like your sister, trying to, you want some coffee or some tea? Can I help you out? And she'd give you, you know, kind of touch you on the shoulder, made you feel like you're at home. Mm-hmm. And later that day, they said, "Do you know that lady is probably the greatest salesman in all of the Twin Cities?" Because she put everybody first all the time, made sure everything is there for mm-hmm. them. And made sure it's what they wanted.
Yeah.
And she put herself last and put everybody else ahead of her. It's a kind of a servant attitude. And most people, not most people, but you have people that want to be served and those that need to serve. Mm-hmm. I think those that need to serve are probably the most blessed.
Yeah.
They find the reward. They're never the poorest. They're never the most frustrated, they're most calming and easiest to be around.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be like John Berkey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to come back to him. I don't think our listeners probably know who he is.
Mm-hmm.
I was telling some other professors about him, and they had never heard of him mm-hmm. either. Do you want to just give us a brief summary of who John Berkey was?
Well, one year, there was the Elvis Presley competition stamp, and he had got turned down for his stamp entry. And one of the students that I had said, "Let's go see him. He's over by Minnetonka on Christmas Lake." Hmm. And I said, "Oh, golly, you know, he's a pretty good-sized name type of illustrator." And she kept pestering me. I said, "Okay, we'll do that."
Mm-hmm.
For the next 11 years, we were always with him. Hmm. We always took trips up.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't really realize how important he was either. He took us right down in his home, and he had his office in the basement, and he treated us like fun of the family, and he showed us how he painted, he showed us how he mixed his colors, and then he went upstairs and he showed all the closets upstairs were filled with his paintings. And I guess I never really did realize how big he was until he passed away, which is sad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was in '98, April of '98. And he had gone to New York to receive the best sci-fi artist of the last 50 years.
Mm.
And he would tell us about stories about the Star Wars because he did the poster for them.
Mm-hmm.
He did. He invented the Death Star.
Yeah.
And he gave them ideas about their projections as far as their filming. And oh my gosh, you know. And he's just talking to us like our neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And it made you feel good. And then looking online to see all the work he had done, he told me that he went to, this might give you more insight too on learning, mm-hmm. is that he was in high school and he got an illustration job at Kalamazoo.
Yeah, the agency in the Twin Cities.
There's that, but then there was a another one. It's it was a calendar company.
Okay.
And maybe it'll come to me, but mm-hmm. he said he got to see all the Norman Rockwell originals coming in and all the great illustrators of the golden age of illustration coming in. They'd be on the calendars. And he was an artist before he was 18 there. And I don't know how he got in there. And then he got to be with all these other artists from around the country and world that worked there as illustrators. And he thought, well, he stopped going to that and go to school. He got frustrated with school and went back. He never went to school.
Wow.
He just went to work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you do have those people that that's the best way that they can learn.
Yeah, it's kind of
it's
different
just to get thrown in.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there one time and he made a sandwich for me and he talked to me and he sat down and saw what he was doing. And then I brought my sketchbook. He said, you know, Bob, that's pretty good. And I did an illustration. I thought, oh, God, for him to tell me that, I'm not sure how to take this, you know, because I'm not quite at his level, you know. But I thought, boy, this is great. You know, wouldn't it be nice to, you're always thinking, wouldn't it be nice just to be home and illustrate just like him? But I went away. And I realized I couldn't. I wouldn't be happy. I couldn't be happy just by myself illustrating. I had to be with people. And I think that's pretty important. Like I mentioned earlier, John was at home all the time working, and he'd have repairmen come in, and they'd see him working and thinking he didn't have a job, so he was some kind of a bum, you know. And his wife was working somewhere. And he'd have to nearly apologize for himself, and yet he's doing all this national work for National Geographic and doing these great pieces of work for Sports Illustrated and Popular Mechanics, and knowing everything that he drew had to be correct, and so he had to do research on it. He had to know the audience that would be, and. He actually had dozens of careers because he had to actually know the audience better than he knew himself in order to sell it, and it had to be accurate. And he had, I remember he had a fight with one of the art directors and about a submarine that was coming through the water, and it had to be a certain color. He said, it's not possible. You know? He said, you can't do this. I think he won out, but the art director wanted it a different way, and he said, no, you know, now he becomes a scientist, and a scientist, psychologist, and a chemist, and as an artist, you have to be all those things, and above all, you have to be accurate, because there's so many qualified people out there. So I think he, like most artists, or those that really are very conscious about their work and outcome, they're the hardest on themselves, and it's hard for them to embellish themselves too much because they know the merit of what they've done and what they could have done better.
Yeah, I think that research really shows up well in his work. And thanks for that link that you sent me. We'll put that in the show notes. I was a little bit familiar with his work from doing some research, but just looking through that stuff again today, I was amazed at just the range of things he was able to do and do really well.
I asked him, what do you start out with? You know, he says, I start out with light first. That's where I start. And, everything is light. And that made sense. And he had color experiments on the wall. And different ways of handling light nearby. And he had a device that when he painted, he could stand about 15 feet away and look up at a mirror that was just above him. I think you saw it maybe on his...
I don't know if I saw that one.
Yeah, just above his drawing board. He could look up and it would bounce back, and he could see it about maybe 15 feet away. And you take a look at some of his work, and it's just globs of paint here and there. But if you cut back, it all pulled together.
Hmm.
And it's a little bit like Impressionism, you know.
Right.
But it had a looseness and a quality to it that I think people liked.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's maybe what people like nowadays, too. Someone told me that, why is this... impressionistic style, the loose style, so favorable nowadays. And I said, well, it all depends on what the need is for, but I think a lot of people with such a hurried world need something that has a little casual to look to it, but has a quality to it. And sometimes to a point where it's not completely finished, but that they can finish it themselves so that they can have a feeling of control. Because we see as our economy dips and goes up and down, color changes that reflect our behavior as far as the browns coming in when and the detail coming in when people get more stressed and they need something a little more to hang on to. They go back to something more subtle. And art has a tendency to be that barometer that reflects the culture. Mm-hmm. And the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so art is very very much needed as far as helping people see where they're at.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk a little bit about maybe what you're doing now or what type of work you've done kind of outside of school?
When I retired, I thought, boy, this would be nice, you know. And then after a while, when the old schedules would lock in again in the fall, there was a little bit of... more time than you expected.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found out that when you're focusing on the students, people don't realize that you do artwork. And so I had about 150 paintings underneath the stairway, and I thought, well, maybe I'll get them out there and I'll show people that I do artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And so after 3 years, about 3.5 years now, people realize, oh, where have you been? And most of the work was done in classroom just to help the students to be feel that they could do it too,
mm-hmm.
inspire them. It's no good just to show and tell principals if you can't get in front of them and inspire them. It mm-hmm. doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
I've done some book consulting, and then I've done some, now I'm doing some private lessons, and I've been asked, because I can draw, they can't find anybody who can draw, so I might be doing some design work locally, and then last spring, someone found my work in the McKnight Foundation. It's called artists, that's plural, .org,
mm-hmm.
and any artist that's in Minnesota can put their work on free.
Mm-hmm.
And of all the thousands, they found me. And out of 12 artists in Minnesota, I got to be in a show up in the cities last year.
Oh, wow.
And that was kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also displaying work at different places in the area, and that helps... show people that I do artwork, but also it's pleasing to me because it's artwork that helps people feel good about themselves, too. Mm-hmm. It's more of the local farm community and scenery that they remember,
mm-hmm.
and that's helpful.
Yeah, we'll put a link to that website in the show notes. I think there's quite a bit of your work on there, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
So that'll be really cool.
Yeah.
For people to be able to see that. I think you're a little modest in saying you do book consulting, because I think you've been doing some illustration for some books. So hopefully those will be coming out soon, and we'll be able to take a look at those. So.
Yeah, I think Gordon saw my work down at Passstone, and I keep changing that every other week and keeping moving the pictures around along with the season. And one of the ladies down there came up to me, one of the consultants, and said, oh, I got to talk to you. I said, I've got one fellow, he's an old farmer, and he goes up to this one painting of a reaper going through, and there's a It's in the summertime. Mm-hmm. And he just looks at that for about a half hour before breakfast every morning. Mm-hmm. I think it's that purpose, feeling that you'd help people through that day or getting him going, mm-hmm. that makes you feel good about what you can do mm-hmm. for others. Mm-hmm. And it always comes back. I mentioned what legalism is, where if you do something for me, I'll do something for you. Mm-hmm. I call it divine legalism, where you just give it away and all of a sudden it seems to come back at you double and triple fold. Mm-hmm. And that when you have the attitude of helping somebody with what you can do, it seems better all the way around. Mm-hmm. It's hard to at first because you feel so vulnerable mm-hmm. when you're young or when you feel that you may be cornered somehow. But I had one student. She had bounced around to different colleges for many years, mm-hmm. about three different ones, and she was always contesting me in the classroom. and the St. Peter tornado went through. And she came back 3 days later and she said, "Bob, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to do social work. She said, I just loved it." So, you know, a lot of times out of some disasters or things that don't go right, keeping an open mind, you mm-hmm. kind of find yourself.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's some really great insights.
Mm-hmm. And another student, mm-hmm. she was so busy. She was doing advertising. She was a salesperson, and she said, "Bob, you know, I got rid of my job. I've got a crappy car. I'm helping somebody. I'm doing social work. I'm the happiest I've been for years. I'm doing a little painting right now, mm-hmm. and I'm enjoying it off to the side, but." Realizing you don't have to have a lot of stuff mm-hmm. to be happy. Mm-hmm. And I think people are realizing that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Bob.
Yeah.
I think it's really cool to have someone like you who has all those years of experiences and just all the insights and wisdom you gain from those times and from working with students. I think that's really helpful.
It was a shock to me, Aaron, that I didn't realize I was old until I retired.
Oh,
because
yeah?
You're with young people all the time. And all of a sudden you're with older people. It really is your age. Mm-hmm. And it's a shock. it's been such a mm-hmm. it's such a wonderful experience mm-hmm. to be a teacher for so many years. I hope that you can have both of you experience like that too. Mm-hmm. Stay young.
Yeah.
Mentally, it'll mm-hmm. be fine.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully your grandkids will help you stay that way.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, thank you, Aaron.
Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, Phil, but I think that was one of the most insightful things I've ever heard on this show. The stuff that Bob said.
Oh, it was very... very good to hear. It's interesting to hear some people talk about the educational standpoint of things and mm-hmm. to make mistakes and go outside of your comfort zone. I remember I did a theater class where we had to make props and learn to paint backdrops. And one of the first assignments was we had to paint an old fence. So we all had these boards and we had to paint an old weathered fence on it. And being a perfectionist, I painted the cleanest looking old fence, where it looked like an old fence, and the fact that it was like had holes in it and it was degrading, but it was very clean and not very authentic looking. Mm-hmm. And to be able to kind of a
graceful decay.
No, not even that. It was terrible. But like to learn that type of. To have that environment where you can make those kind of mistakes and have people tell you, mm-hmm. Good job, but it's way too clean to be an old fence. Yeah, to set up a support system for failure, I think that's super, super valuable
mm-hmm.
and good to hear him talk about that.
You know what I really like about this show, Phil?
No, I will in a minute.
Besides the fact that you're the co-host. I really like that there are a lot of common themes that run through it, like not being afraid of failure and things that sound really stupidly simple, like, oh, well, of course. But they're actually really hard in practice. But not only that, but just hearing the more specific things to people's experiences in this industry. You know, when Bob talks about, I had this student who had this problem, or I helped them with this, or when you're working with students, this is something really important. I think it's those unique things combined with the common threads that are really interesting to me.
Yeah. A lot of good insight.
Where can people find notey things about the show?
The show notes?
Yeah.
Those should be at the Creative Circle Podcast website, which is creativecirclepodcast.com/7 will get you to this show. Otherwise, if you just do a search for Bob Williams, you should find it right in the show title.
Yep. Just don't Google his name, because there's like some other Bob Williamses who are not this one. So you might... I mean, you could try, but it probably won't be the first thing.
Okay. Well, thank you everybody for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Catch you next week.